Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So continuing now our discussion on the sort of constitutional implications of these revelations from Scott Shane of the New York Times, Lawrence Tribe, Carl M. Loeb, University Professor at the Harvard Law School, continuing now with us. Professor Tribe, it seems to me that the vice president puts an awful lot of credence in the commander-in-chief phrase in Article 2 of the Constitution as empowering the executive to make almost any program secret and to withhold it from the Congress under almost any circumstances. Is there precedent for that?
Well, I think that goes farther than we've ever gone in our history. And I think it goes farther in at least, I'd say, four respects. I mean, to begin with, there is the kind of vertical checks and balances in the Constitution that involve the relationship between the executive and the legislature. And in wartime as well as in peace, regardless of what emergency we face, the executive is not commander-in-chief of the nation, but only of the military. But then there is also a second dimension, a kind of horizontal dimension, the relationship between the president and the vice president. And I think we've already seen that in the last administration, we had a vice president who governed from an undisclosed location in more ways than one and who often claimed to be a fourth branch of government. There's a third dimension, a kind of active-passive distinction. It's true that the obligation of the executive branch to inform Congress is one that is a matter of degree. The Constitution expressly requires the president to give Congress information about the State of the Union, and the rest is within executive discretion. But here we have an active decision by the executive branch to withhold information, an order to the CIA. And finally, there's the fourth dimension, a dimension of time. It is said by the defenders of what Cheney did that this program hadn't been executed yet. But as Scott Shane emphasizes, the National Security Act extends any significant anticipated intelligence activity.
Right.
Well, so at least these four ways, we've got a vice president who has at least arguably gone beyond the law.
Well, lots to think about there. Let me get a quick response to John Kyle, the minority whip that Farai played that clip a moment ago. He claims here that the president and vice president are the two people who have responsibility ultimately for the national security of the country. Would the framers have understood that to be true?
Well, I think after the revolution against King George, they would have had their doubts. The legislature has a powerful and important role in making sure that the ultimate security of the country, which is a security that is ensured by having checks and balances and the separation of powers, is not sacrificed on the altar of expediency.
All right. You referred to the 1947 Security Act, which talks about the specific forms whereby the government will inform Congress about secret programs. During the Iran-Contra affair, the Bolin Amendment, an explicit legislative amendment which caused which ordered the executive to behave in a particular way, was ignored or allegedly ignored during the Iran-Contra hearings or during the Iran-Contra period. And that produced an enormous number of hearings and oversight and a relooking at that policy. That was a fairly ambiguous amendment, the Bolin Amendment. This is much more specific. Do you think it will have the effect of opening a similar set of hearings, or will Congress just leave it alone?
Well, I hope Congress doesn't just leave it alone. Congress has an obligation that corresponds to its power and its authority, an obligation to effectively check the executive. And here we do have, as you say, a quite specific statute, the National Security Act of 1947, in which the intelligence committees, which were established to deal with earlier abuses, and to serve as the eyes and ears of the public, are to be kept, and the language is clear, fully and currently informed of the intelligence activities of the United States. It is true that there is some fuzzy language at the end. It says that this briefing process should be done to the extent consistent with due regard for the protection for unauthorized disclosure of classified information. But that really relates to the details with which matters should be briefed, the number of people who should be briefed. And I do agree with some in the Obama administration who are saying that we ought not to micromanage those details by statute. But it's one thing to say that we will only let the chair of various committees know, and another thing to say that we will allow the vice president of the United States simply to issue a blanket order to keep this secret.
Lawrence Tribe of Harvard, very, very quickly, just a couple of seconds. Is there precedent for really looking at this in constitutional terms as opposed to just sort of smoking gun terms?
Well, I think throughout our history, we have looked at these things in constitutional terms. There's not much precedent for having courts play a very active role in policing the precise boundary, but we already know that with respect to the Bush administration's claims...
Well, there'll be more talk about it, that's for sure. Lawrence Tribe talking about the constitutional issues in Vice President Cheney's actions.